This podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided with the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help, seek out a qualified medical services provider or other healthcare professional. Welcome to the Live Your Yoga Podcast, a podcast dedicated to discovering and sharing all the ways in which yoga can be lived off the mat. Real stories by real people, just like you.
Welcome to the Live Your Yoga Podcast. My name is Mark, faculty member and teacher for Your Yoga Flow. Today, my guest on the podcast is Tiffany Sparrow. Tiffany is a musician, a yoga teacher, music therapist, and more. And our conversation today is about using music as a healing tool and ways that we can integrate music practices into our lives. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Tiffany. And we'll dive in now. Tiffany, thank you so much for coming onto the Live Your Yoga Podcast.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
I'd love for you to tell us just a little bit about yourself, sort of a brief summary, if you can, about who you are.
I love it because this is a question that I've been asked. I ask people some of it. It's like, well, about myself. Well, I am a musician, multi-instrumentalist. I am a longtime yogi. I've been practicing and teaching since 2003. So long time. I am a music therapist and so clinical music therapist. So that's what I did kind of my formal university in. And then also beyond that have gone into sound therapy, and there are sort of subtle differences in terms of approach and just, you know, what those two things mean. We were just talking about this. I am a gypsy at heart, though I've been in Edmonton for 8 years, so a gypsy in different ways. So I love other cultures. I feel an affinity to India and to Australia, to Indonesia. So I've done a lot of world travels and have studied ethnomusicology. Actually, I did my master's in ethnomusicology. So that's the study of music and culture, and usually music of the world. And I did my thesis on group chanting or kirtan. So was able to do a lot of, you know, observation, interviews, field recording, just talking to people about the health benefits of that. The ways I identify myself, I guess.
No, I love it. There's so much in there. Wow. Like, we'd need like 7 episodes or something to get through all of it. What I love, like, I mean, I'm always really, as a musician, I'm drawn to other musicians. And I think it's really fascinating the things that you've chosen to do with music, like the path that music has led you down, because it can be so varied. And I'm just really inspired by the fact that a lot of, it seems like what you're doing is using music as a healing tool.
Yep. I would agree. That's sort of the overarching umbrella, for all of the little offshoots in terms of like how that shows up. The overarching is, I mean, I usually say music for transformation. I mean, there's words and language are interesting too, but yes, as a healing health wellness tool. And that's something that, you know, people have been doing, you know, we call it ubiquitous, right? It's been happening across, in different places, across cultures, across time. But in terms of our adoption of, you know, looking at music that way, in North America, there's still, you know, a lot more to relearn, I guess I could say, or I think people are drawn to it instinctively for different things, you know, like relaxing or exercising, that kind of thing. But there's so much more to it besides that, to delve into.
Who were your, like, how did you even get into music in the first place?
Well, I'm one of the lucky people that music has been practiced kind of in a folk family kind of way within my mom and my uncles and my my granny, you know, there was always music in the house for them. Granny played piano and often entertained back in the day, before Netflix and chill, and way before that, that's what they did. And then, yeah, my uncle would come up from, he lives in Vancouver. Actually, he's sort of he's an entertainer, and we'd come out, and family gathers would always revolve around, there would always be like long evening music, right? Where we'd sing along Beatles and Eagles and like all of those kind of classic oldies. And my mom sang in church. And so it's just kind of been there. Music has kind of been there in my family. And so I'm really fortunate for that, because not everyone has that. And I think that has afforded me a certain level of familiarity and comfort with it. So that was kind of like the initial onset of it. And then for me, as I don't know how much you want me to get into my journey, but I've battled eating disorders at a really young age. And part of my way through was through music. And a lot of the traditional treatments are cognitive behavioral therapy and medication. And I really found that those didn't quite get to the core of the discomfort that I was experiencing, an embodied discomfort. Lots of ways to work with the mind and repatterning thoughts. And that's still really out there with mindset, and that's great. But I really found that I couldn't just think myself well through it, and had to find more embodied practices like yoga. Sound is, you know, even though we often think about music and sound through our ears, we actually take it in through our whole essence and being. I mean, you just have to go to one rave or sit beside one loud car bassy driver to like realize it's like, oh yeah, I actually take it in through my whole body. Right. So, I mean, long story short, music and sound have really kind of been my healer and my way through as well. Yeah.
Wow. That's a pretty incredible journey.
Mm-hmm. It's been definitely interesting. And within that, that took me down, you know, learning traditional music voice lessons, traditional piano, you know, classical kind of realms into university, into a performance route. And what was interesting about that for me, in my particular heart space and head space, was that a performance-based program was really challenging in terms of the perfectionism, the standards, and like all of those things that were already really present for me with in my embodiment and my eating disorder. And so it wasn't quite a fit for me, even though I loved music. And so it just was sort of the timing. It was around the time of, I don't know if you've heard of the Mozart effect, had kind of come out, that book around, you know, oh, play this tune and you can have this, you know, whatever result, but, which is kind of oversimplified in terms of how music works. It's a lot more intricate than that. But, yeah, my mom basically heard about this thing called music therapy, and then through connections got to talk to a woman who did it and actually practiced it. And I just felt like, yes, this is a really nice combination of my interest in helping and understanding the human condition from psychological perspectives, and then using music as a way to connect with other people and with myself, as opposed to all of that, the stress I felt around having to like make it all about me and perform and just all the things that I did with that. It doesn't have to be that way, performance, but it can be. There can be those pressures. So, yeah.
Well, I'm like, there's so many things running through my head right now. I mean, I know this is a yoga podcast, but I wish that like every musician who I know in my life who also went through a performance program like me and you could hear those words, because they're not shared very often in those types of programs. And that perfectionism and that sort of negative self-talk is just so, it's just endemic sort of in that world. So it's really like, it makes me quite emotional to hear you talk about that, because I think you're sort of shining a light on an issue, and you found this like wonderful path through that way, where it's like so you can have a love of music and express it in sort of more holistic ways.
Yep. Well said.
That's so mind blowing to me.
Yeah. And you know what? I would say that there are definitely some people, again, I'd like to say that that's you know, that's how I dealt with it. Some people deal with it really well. Some people are really good under that pressure. Some people actually thrive under highly competitive environments. I am not that person. And there are, you're right. There are a lot of people that, don't, and it can shut down people and people's love for music and performance. And so it's just a matter of, I think more and more us reclaiming that or taking ownership over, you know, what is right for us and what isn't. And, you know, we can veer into yoga from, I mean, where I was first exposed to yoga was in university, right? It kind of as a coping, if you will, or, I mean, I'd kind of seen it in magazines and books and kind of did my own exploration in small town Alberta, right? But when I was trying to work my way through my own embodiment issues, but it was really when I got to the city that I was first exposed to like a yoga posture class. And I started to take that with a really beautiful teacher. I think she was trained in Kripalu primarily. And so her classes, and I've reached out to her since, her classes were so, they were unique, you know, they were different each time. There was like interesting elements. There was also like meditations that I just remember it feeling really like creative. And there's like this sparkly kind of thing as I remember, even though I don't remember the details. So started to get interested in yoga there. And just really liked what yoga has to say about spirituality. You know, having been raised in Catholicism and where spirituality is very much important to my parents, but it was never luckily forced on me. I never had to go, even though music is a way that my mom does her devotion, right? In church, which is, I've taken that too, but into different realms. So there was a, you know, a real deep connection to spirituality for me as well through my family, which I'm also grateful for. But the way that they practiced it didn't quite resonate for many reasons. And I know that that also is a common thread amongst a lot of us in this time now, you know, like the spiritual but not religious uprising that's been happening more and more in the last few decades in North America. Yeah.
And so how did you start to integrate your sort of the music part of your life with the yogic part of your life? Was that an easy thing to do or?
So what was neat in music therapy training, is that there is a recognition of spiritual health and well-being as being an important part of, you know, domains of wellness that, you know, we can and need to address with people if it's important to them. You know, it's definitely all about the people that we're working with. And so we were already having those conversations about, you know, mysticism and flow space and all these things with music within my music therapy training. And then when I went to do my internship, post-graduation, 1,000-hour internship, and this was in Calgary, I ended up in going to a gym regularly, and I would go into the squash courts and start doing, I just would do my own yoga kind of, I would do a little cardio and go do some yoga. And the manager there was, you know, he was into martial arts. And so he would sometimes talk about mysticism and energy and spirituality. And just one day he walked by and he was like, "You ever thought about being a teacher, like a yoga teacher?" And he just kind of said it. And as soon as he said it was like, bing, you know, like it was like, oh no, but cool. So literally that day we went into his office, and that was back in the day when we still had yellow pages.
Oh, nice.
Went through the yellow pages in Calgary and found like, you know, a yoga studio, which is still there, and called a few of them. And this one studio happened to be having yoga teacher training starting. And so as I was doing my internship in music therapy, I was doing this training in yoga. And so there was sort of those two presences happening for me in my own life, in my own practice. But it really wasn't until I went on and did another training in Nelson, and I was first exposed to kirtan, which is a form of call and response group singing. And this is probably, when was this? Back in 2004 or 5, I want to say. You know, the first time I was exposed to that it was like, okay, there's something really, really cool here in terms of just the intersection between yogic practices and mantra, and a lot of spiritual talk and devotion, and then sound and the idea of social and group and in it together, and some of the things I'd learned in music therapy. So that's kind of where the intersection really came together for me.
And how did that look from sort of a yoga teaching perspective? Like, were you teaching classes and weaving mantra in, or were you teaching mantra mostly, or
I think it started more in the latter, and kind of still kind of, and honestly, they are still kind of separate though. Like when I do teach asana, which is very rare these days, I'll do some subbing, but I always do bring in mantra. I do talk about it a little bit and then always, sing in Shavasana with it. But, it tended to be more like, okay, well, we'll do like a kirtan kind of gathering. I'll do some lectures for other yoga teacher trainings or, specific courses around mantra. And then within asana classes, bring it in a little bit. And that's had various iterations. Like I've collaborated with teachers where we've done, depending on, the group, again, the teacher's sensitivities, because people come and go with how much they're open to mantra still, unfortunately. I mean, it's growing. I think it's really the medicine of the future, but that's me. But, I've collaborated with teachers where, we'll really weave in, someone will be teaching like a yin posture, and within that yin posture, especially some of them, well, any of them, right? But to help with focus, to help with moving through whatever's coming up, I'll be chanting something, and people are encouraged to sound and chant along within the posture. So anything from that to one of my teachers, Yogrishi Vishvikatu, has a system of hatha, he called Hatha Raj, where he blends Brahmari breath, which is, if you don't know, it's basically integration of humming, and there's different things you can do with mudras and stuff, but essentially it's humming, humming breath. And there's lots of science starting to happen now about humming, which is really cool. But, so within these postures, it's a fairly slow, steady practice, about 40 minutes of asana, where you hum, you do maybe 3 to 5 cycles of humming and then come into a different posture and hold and hum. And it really sets up, our neurology and our bodies for a deep meditation. And so the class always ends in a deep meditation. So it's been a kind of a wide range to answer your question of how that's looked. I will say that there's still been some resistance, if you will, that I still, keyed to, especially in Alberta around what is this mantra stuff, right? And, bringing it in, and because I'm not teaching asana as much anymore, I'm not, that's not really as much of an issue, but, I've been to places like there's a place in California called the Bhakti Yoga Shala, where it's very much a big part of every asana class. There's maybe live musicians playing, there's, usually kirtan kind of integrated, so it's just interesting how it shows up differently in different places.
I find it fascinating that you said that mantra will be the medicine of the future.
I'm kind of usurping that from Edgar Cayce's. There's a quote by him around, music and sound in general being the medicine of the future. And I really have to say that, it's been layers and layers and layers of me moving into a place of liberation from the chains that bound me to eating disorders, right? But it's really been in the last few years, having met another teacher who's very, very bhakti yoga, and we can talk about what that means in a moment, but very much about devotional practices and very much about mantra. There's been a really subtle but massive, if that makes sense for me. It's been on the subtle levels, maybe, right? Shift in terms of the sense of freedom I feel that I have, or the sense of neutrality that I now have around things that used to really cause a lot of anxiety and a lot of tightening of grip for me. It's really been through the wisdom of a regular mantra practice, I feel, that's really helped in that sense. And there's a lot to learn about it still, a lot still to be learned about it. A lot of, from what I can tell from the academics who are doing really cool work and research, like research practitioners, like who are both practitioners and academics, there's still so much, literature, like in Sanskrit, that has yet to be translated. There's like a lot that we still don't know from the ancient teachings, that's exciting for me too.
So do you find it's an interesting balance between your brain as like a researcher? Because obviously you have that part of yourself that's the ethnomusicologist, and then the sort of the practice part of it, the like the bhakti yoga part of it. Like that's a really interesting combination for a person to have, I think.
Like, yeah, I mean, I think I would still, my dominant is more in action and practice, I would say. Like if it's, if it wasn't showing up in practice, I wouldn't care what the research said, to be honest with you. If it didn't, if it didn't have practical application, it's sort of, the research would matter less to me. But the research is important in terms of informing, you know, it can help us try out new things in practice. And also it's important to appease the questioning skeptic brain that can be there. And especially in North America too, there's still a lot of reliance, and for good reason. I think it's good to not just have blind faith mm-hmm. in things. I need to actually look into this more, but I was told when I was in, spent a lot of time in McLeod Ganj up in Dharamshala up in India, where there's the Dalai Lama has his residence and there's a lot of Buddhism there. And someone once told me something about the process. The ideal process in Buddhism is to spend years and years looking for your guru, looking for your teacher. And they, in Tibetan Buddhism anyways, as far as I know, they really encourage debating skills and the ability to discuss these different spiritual passages and debate and such, and use your intellect and your conscious reasoning. But then once you have exhausted all of the skepticism, all of the questioning, then turn that off, and then you surrender, and then you follow your teacher, then you follow the teachings, right? And that's always made a lot of sense to me. A lot of sense.
That's so cool. I've never heard that before, but it also like resonates quite deeply just hearing you say that, like that. Yeah, because you could question forever, but at a certain point, got to go with the faith, I guess.
Yeah. So it's good to like, okay, well, if that's something that you have, like lean into it. Okay. Like let's just explore the skepticism and let's ask those questions and let's, you know, I have to look into, I can't even remember who told me, or it's just stuck with me, or maybe I just made it up or something. I don't think
it's
so.
Great.
I've seen Buddhists like doing their debating and, you know, like there's slapping down their hands, and like I've seen it in action. You know, there's more for me to learn about that. So I'm sorry if I'm misquoting something, but it's just, that to me has made sense.
Just circling back to bhakti yoga too, because I do want to talk about that, because I think for a lot of people, we have a lot of students who will be listening, and that's a completely new concept to them. And lots of them are in North America or Europe, and there might not be sort of a deeper understanding of what bhakti is. So it would be so wonderful if you sort of could tell us a little bit more about what bhakti yoga is for you.
Yes, for me. Thank you. I'm like, wow, there's so many different layers of them. I mean, there are different streams, different paths of yoga, you know, and if yoga were the mountain, if you will, there are many paths to it. And I often say, you know, yoga is not a thing we do or an action. It's a state. It's that state of unification and just tapping into that place where, you know, where we are all connected, even though there is separation. That is a reality on some levels, right? But there's also a reality where's the unification. So yoga and different is a way of accessing different practices, to come into that state of union. And so different streams, right? So we've got the bhakti is one of them. There's the hatha stream with the posture practice and the purifications and the kriyas. There's gyan yoga, which is more to do with collection of knowledge and study of scriptures, you know, either in writing or just receiving them from a teacher and just pondering in the mind. There's Raj yoga, which tends to sometimes be lumped in with hatha yoga, but you know, it has to do more with contemplation and meditation practices. There's karma yoga, which is the yoga of action and service, being in service, selfless service ideally. And then there's bhakti, which typically means devotion or, you know, sometimes called yoga of the heart, and tends to involve, mainly mantra or chanting prayerful practices to help to tune into and connect with the divine spark and that state of oneness and unity. So yes, a lot of it's very much heavily lays into mantra practice and recitation and prayer, and can sometimes look like fire pujas, as they're called, or trying to think of like an English word equivalent for puja, but a cleansing devotional practice where You're honoring the element of fire, and fire even as a form of spirit, or sometimes as a deity. And I approach deities or gods and goddesses more as energies or archetypes, you know, that we can identify with, and energies that can move through us. And so honoring the fire as a form of spirit that we, you know, offer to with herbs or and oil and ghee and that kind of thing, and say prayers. And the whole idea is just to practice, be more and more in this state of honoring, reverence, awe, devotion for the spiritual realm, for devotion, and to allow that to infiltrate in through, you know, any of the busyness, any of the worry, any of the attachments, any of that kind of thing, and just let it help to loosen, for me anyways, loosen the grip on some of these very human things that we experience. Very normal, natural things that we experience as humans.
So what does that look like in like a, it's hard to say probably because days are so varied, but like, how do you integrate that into a day? Like typically?
I have a morning and an evening practice, basically, just like I do some movement based, kind of a mixture of some asana with a little bit more sort of strengthening and some breathing kind of stuff for about 20 minutes. And then I will do 15 to 20 minutes of mantra practice. And so there's a whole range of, there's one mantra that my teacher has given me that, you know, I will do every day in the morning. And then beyond that, there's many different kinds of mantras, some for, you know, connecting with the elements and, you know, cleansing and relating to the chakras. Sometimes I'll, you know, clear out my own energy centers. There's, you know, the Gayatri mantra, which is a really beautiful mantra to connect with the light and the sun. There's many different practices that can be brought in. So yeah, I've got some time in the morning and the evening.
So I love it because it's so practical. And I think when we first learn about bhakti yoga in like a teacher training program, it seems quite esoteric and out there, or that you have to be in, you know, a certain space with people and instruments. And it's really lovely to hear about it being sort of brought back into a home practice.
To me, foremost, I mean, each has its own advantages. You know, I will sometimes talk about, you know, if I'm offering mantra in a kirtan space, versus more of like a japa or a recitate. Both involve recitation and repetition, but japa being a practice where you would, you know, you take a mala and, you know, repeat a certain amount of times, a certain, you know, phrase, incantation, right? Or an intoned phrase, which is a mantra. Usually a little bit more, less melodious, you know, when I'm doing that practice, usually somewhere around here, these throw, no, 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 no. Usually that's sort of more of traditional, like, I'm trying to think of one right off the top. Om bur bur vasvaha tat savitur varenyam bargo devasya dimahi diyo yona prachodayat. You know, that would be kind of like the range that I would do in a japa practice versus something that's got more of a melody in more of a kirtan kind of group singing space that tends to just have a different flavor to it. And it's less about how many times did we repeat. Not that it's ever really about that either. Like for every time I say that there's like a certain stipulation, I'm like, well, it doesn't have to be that way. But typically 108 repetitions is, you know, the place to start, right, with a japa practice. But within kirtan, it's more about the community too, right? It is more about connection through sound and, you know, more the musical elements and, you know, maybe the joy. And this came out in my research too, people talking a little bit about the difference of, you know, maybe tapping into the external, bigger, connecting to self as beyond self. And within my japa personal practice, it feels more like in here and the thin thread line within myself, if that makes sense. And so both are important, both are part of us, but just different kind of qualitatively.
That's fascinating. And I love that you mentioned community, because sometimes yoga can seem quite like a solitary solo practice, which is great because sometimes that's exactly what we need. But I think what's so appealing about bhakti yoga is that community and also the joy that you mentioned, like the joy that's cultivated through music for anybody is just so incredible.
Mm-hmm. It's key. Definitely key. There can be something, I think it's part of what, you know, when, yes, asana practice can be solitary, but I think people go out to community classes for community, right? You go out to a group, there's a certain, you know, even though everyone's on their mat, you know, you're still, you know, there's breathing happening. There's what's happening in the group is still part of your experience. And so there can even be a bit of an ease with that. I know definitely within the Ashtanga world, it's felt that way too, as we all get into breathing kind of together. You know, Ashtanga yoga is really kind of set up that way for sure, to coordinate breathing and movement and in train together, that there can be a sense of then being carried together. I know that I've heard people talk about that when it comes to kirtan, and even things around, you know, people's own stories and worries with their own sound and their own voice, and that, you know, group singing like that in kirtan can be a really great way to enter in to that and just start to play around with our birthright, our own healing tool that we all have, our voices, when it can sometimes feel really intimidating, and sometimes people have been shut down from that. Lots of stories around that, but it can be a way into that.
So speaking about those people who, you know, maybe don't have a musical background, but they're interested in bringing chanting, mantra, bhakti yoga type practices into their own practice, what would be sort of the, like, a way in that you might suggest?
I mean, om and humming, you know, are really, really good places, really accessible places. I mean, om is a mantra, basically. And it's the sound om. You can go aum, but really the Sanskrit writing of om is aum, and so that's correct, but the au sound in Sanskrit makes an o sound. So practicing with om and just as a, you know, a really basic place to just kind of play around with sounds, even around sort of the speaking range. So I would tend to sort of, you know, just dive in right here and just start to lengthen my, you know, hum kind of thing. Beyond that, though, if even that feels intimidating, I would say start to listen and look around. You can, you know, Google kirtan, you can Google mantra. I've got a little bit of music online that is kirtan based. So I would just start with listening and just finding some things that resonate, and that can be a really good entry point. So whatever is really appealing to the individual is really important.
No, it's super helpful. It's because I know I've had students, like, I'm sure many yoga teachers have, when you're finishing the class and you're like, let's do om, and you're the only one, you know, you invite people to join in and everyone's a little shy. But I'm sure that if people were used to doing it at home as part of a home practice and sort of developing that confidence, that it would make such a big difference. Even yoga teachers who are afraid to use their voices that way.
Yeah. I mean, there, you know, you can do things as a yoga teacher, you can do things like doing a cleansing breath first. You're like, deep breath in and, you know, or like, it just makes some sort of noise, right? It doesn't have, you know, just like, and even that can be weird for some people, but just like, start, like you said, starting to normalize it, starting to bring it in. First and foremost, yes, as a teacher, it's got to be in your practice too, right? That was with anything that we're teaching. It's in order for it to be authentic, it's got to be also in our practices. I also find that explaining a little bit about, you know, why, and there's many reasons why, and just coming in prepared to, you know, just kind of normalize it and say, you know, like, you know, sounding can be a really great way for us to bring culmination or conclusion to what we're doing, or, you know, to end with a sense of connection between us, or to honor the ancient practices, or, you know, on and on and on. There's lots of ways you could kind of justify it to people that might be intimidated as students. That is something that I do. I will just sort of mention that's something that I work with people to do. I do teach in advance, usually in advance, like 500 hour YTTs, but then I also do work individually with people, usually in a mixed kind of program involving some theory and lecture around mantra and the history and the different mantras, but then also, you know, their own personal practice and even healing within that, that can happen through sounding. Yeah. So we'll just put that out there. If people are curious, that's something you can reach out to me about.
No, for sure. We'll link all your links in the show notes so people can find you. Cause I think that is such an important thing for people to have access to, and being guided by someone as knowledgeable as yourself and as compassionate as yourself is what really will make the difference for them.
Yeah, I definitely have been a fan of, for myself anyways, having teachers. I have three or four people that I call on currently for different, you know, posture practice, the bhakti practice, the healing work in practice. And so all of them, I still do my own work with them, right? I think it's just a good thing in general to have teachers around and guidance. And they do say that mantras are most potent when passed down that way from a teacher that has been working with it and knows, you know, how it works for them, and has been given, you know, through that lineage, that whole lineage idea, right? That there's like a certain different quality to it, as opposed to just kind of going on the internet and finding something alone, right? But
I think before, because I also want to just ask you about your music therapy practice and sort of more about the offerings you have about that. But I think before I go to there, we ask everybody this, which is, how do you live your yoga? I know you've answered it probably throughout our conversation together, but if you could maybe like summarize it.
So what's coming to me to share is the mantra, Lokasamasta Sukhino Bhavantu. And, you know, that the meaning behind that mantra is may all beings in all worlds be happy and free from the roots of suffering, basically. And so as I attempt to, you know, these different practices are for me, you know, so that I might, you know, seek to unhook myself more and more from these things that can bind me to suffering. I also feel like that helps me get into a space where I can then be less triggered as I move out into the world, and hope to hold more compassion for people and be able to hold space more and more for people who want to also unhook from the roots of suffering, if you will. So I'm very much a fan of the walk your talk kind of thing. I'm not about, you know, do as I say, not as I do. I feel like yoga is a really awesome tool. For me, it's been about the emotional realm, like in the way that the mind and the emotions have impacted my feelings of being in my body. But mantra practice has been a really good way for me to navigate the murky waters of the emotions and continue to do that and dive even deeper. So I hope that answers the question.
For sure. And I love that you like used a mantra to answer the question, because that's amazing.
I've been wanting to get it tattooed on my wrist and I just haven't done that, but that's there too.
It's a great idea. So you mentioned at the start of the podcast that you're also a music therapist, like a clinical, you said clinical?
Yep.
Clinical music therapist. So I wondered if you could just maybe tell us a little bit about what that's like.
Yeah. So it's basically using music as a container for connection with people, to help people work through different non-musical challenges. So these days, yeah, it tends to center again, kind of in the emotional realm. So unpacking, you know, depression, anxiety, and even more so within that, like how those relate to body image and eating disorders tends to be, because it's a big part of my own story. A lot of us, you know, take our medicine and serve the world when, you know, once we've navigated it within ourselves, right? So that's been a big part of what I've done in the last 5 years for sure, and more so on a more public and less clinical way. So I do work in hospital setting less now in the last year, because that's been, you know, interesting. But I do some distance work. I'm at a distance. And yeah, so that's been meaning that I've branched into more working with people on the spectrum of body image and embodiment and, you know, disordered eating and all of that kind of thing that comes with that. And so music ends up being kind of like the container, and it comes up in, you know, in different ways in terms of, you know, talking to people about their preferences, weaving things in terms of, you know, sometimes singing or listening or lyric analysis, which can be a way to give insight into the psyche or the emotions, or help that be expressed. You know, even, connecting through movement and sound to the different energy centers is a really good warm up that I end up doing with a lot of people as we prepare to work together. And music becomes a container for then other things. So be it kind of counseling, coaching kind of things that happen. Again, it sort of depends on how, what's the word, woo maybe, or how open a person is, right? Like when I'm in the hospital setting, it's a little bit less, it's more like conversation discussion. When I'm working more privately, it ends up being more, and again, the words aren't great, but shamanic journey ish or healing based meditation around, different emotions often and how those can show up in our bodies and linking sensation to feeling, right? And just helping to unpack some of the heaviness that can come from emotions like shame and anger and sadness and all that kind of thing. But then also different archetypes that run through a lot of inner family dynamics. I work with inner child and inner parents and different, all kinds of different things show up depending on the person. So that's why I call it shamanic. My teacher would maybe not call it that so much. I don't know, she maybe would. It's more of a mystery school lineage that I've come through and adopted some of these healing techniques from. But so kind of weave things through with the clinical side, depending on who I'm working with. Again, which means tends to be more talk based and more kind of song based to meditative, depending on who I'm working with.
And that's something that people can find you online and then work with you.
One-on-one work these days. I've got some things in the mix that I'm just kind of beta testing right now with a couple of people around actually learning about sound medicine and, what that looks like. So again, some theory around, sound medicine and, singing bowls and percussion and voice. Sparsed in with our own healing. All of it always comes down to, doing our individual healing work too, as much as we're doing education and theory and that kind of thing. So, that's more in the works. I haven't quite launched that yet, but if people are curious about, wanting to learn about that kind of thing, singing bowls, people are interested in, and they're deceptively simple singing bowls because, really like they're percussive and friction based. And so it seems like they are more accessible than say a violin for people, right? Which can take hours and hours to master. However, they are also really, really powerful. And when I'm working with someone, I never ever do more than like 10 minutes of crystal sound just because of the quality of the sound, for example. Right. And, something I almost always put out there is that just as much as sound can be, beneficial, there's also downsides to it. I'm sure we can all think of the music that we don't like or just sounds that have rubbed us and irritated us. And, you take that to an extreme level, they do use sound in torture. Not that we're going there, but like, wow. I've read articles. It's almost funny. I've read articles about like, I think it was Justin Bieber music, like played maximum volumes on repetition, along with other sensory deprivation, and you can just imagine days and days of, baby, oh baby, baby, hope we don't need a copyright for that. But anyways, not to end on that note, but this, it's important to get informed.
Totally. Totally. And speaking of like things happening in the future, what do you have upcoming, that people might love to know about?
So I am launching my first solo summit. Well, it's not my solo summit because there's like 20 to 30 speakers that are coming on with it, but it's called Love How You Look. And it's aimed at, helping us dissolve and ditch body image stories and find more freedom and, peace in our bodies, basically. So we've got speakers from quite a diverse range of backgrounds, from, psychologists and counselors to, coaches to yogis to artists and musicians and photographers. And so everyone kind of talking about their own experiences and their work with people through their different modalities to help us all come to a deeper level of acceptance and to unhook those hooks that keep us bound to that suffering of there is one type, I'm not good enough, I don't fit the beauty mold, like that whole restrictive package that's, still out there in the matrix. And, I could go on and on about, why that's there in terms of just you know, money and marketing and that whole thing, but just to help us unhook from that so that we have more sovereignty, so that we have more room for, you know, self knowledge and choice, basically, right? And my body, my choice, and really in many ways, that's a big part of what motivates what I do.
So we'll link all the links that you have and we'll put them in there so people can easily find their way. And I also just wanted to encourage people to just go on your website and to play The Miracle, which is one of your songs that I've been listening to. And what really moved me was the video, because I don't know who those people were who in the video are singing along with you. And it's just really powerful. And the words are really powerful. And I just really hope that people take the time to go check that out, because it will really, I think it will make their day.
Thanks for saying that. And we didn't even really talk about the songwriting stuff. It's all good. But yes, it's meant to be a song to, you know, especially when it's feeling like life is challenging and when people are feeling like, you know, alone and that the path through isn't clear. That's what the song is about. Just remembering that, you know, you got this, it's within you. And we know that too.
It's really powerful. It's so powerful. So yeah, I hope everyone gets to listen to it, because it's something that needs to be heard. So just so great that it's there on your website. How amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. I mean, I do have my guitar here beside me, but I don't know, we're kind of going long on time here.
They can listen to the song and they'll get to hear it. Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us today. I really, really appreciate it. And I know that our listeners will get so much. I mean, we covered so much and there's so much more to cover, but I think this is a great intro into who you are, what you do, what you offer, and the intersection of music and yoga. So thank you.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to be here and to chat with you.